and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
The right wing is going to have a field day with this contract.
A live report as Chicago Teachers Union delegates vote on that new contract. Changes are coming to Cook County's electronic monitoring program, how the chief judge's office is preparing. Suburban voters cast their ballots yesterday for mayoral candidates and issues like tax increases, Cook County Clerk Monica Gordon on turnout, and much more.
The biggest thing is just for them to be, hope this just sparks or ignites just one little piece of passion.
And a city event aimed at empowering young women. First off tonight, as we speak, the Chicago Teachers Union's 730-strong House of Delegates is preparing to vote on whether to approve a new four-year contract. After nearly a year of contentious negotiations, the union's leaders and big bargaining team endorsed a contract that they say is a historic achievement. Our reporter Matt Masterson joins us now live from CTU headquarters with more. Matt, give us a quick recap on the highlights of the deal that the delegates are reviewing tonight.
Yeah, Brandis, so those 730 delegates are in the Chicago Teachers Union headquarters behind me, poring over a four-year contract that Chicago Public Schools officials say is worth about $1.5 billion. Now, that's going to include annual raises starting at 4% for teachers. It includes more prep time for elementary school teachers, enforceable class size limits. It also increases funding for sports programming and includes new services and protections for the students who are most vulnerable throughout the Chicago Public School District. It also adds first-time provisions of academic freedom after CTU pushed for what it calls a force field in this contract against possible attacks from the Trump administration in Washington.
Matt, where do things stand with the vote? For example, is it basically a done deal at that point, and or is there a likelihood that the delegates could reject this deal?
Deliberations are ongoing, but there will be a resolution later tonight. There's going to be some dissension. This is not a perfect contract, but in all likelihood, this is going to be an approval from the House of Delegates that will move this vote on. There's been high confidence from union leaders. They've spoken in glowing terms about this deal, and there have been previous tentative agreements in previous rounds of bargaining that have come after much more contentious negotiations with Chicago Public Schools that still led to a contract and approval vote from the delegates. So it's very, very likely that this is going to be approved tonight and moved on to the rank and file members from the Chicago Teachers Union, who will then need to approve this deal for it to be finalized from the union standpoint. The Chicago Board of Education will then need to finally approve this as well to make sure this deal is done later this month.
And going forward, you know, what does this contract mean if and when it's approved? What does it mean for, you know, students and educators, but also the finances of the district?
Well, one of the biggest things is that there will not be a strike. There won't be a teacher's strike. This will be the first time in 15 years that the Chicago Teachers Union has reached a new contract without taking a strike vote. Of course, there were work stoppages back in 2019 and in 2012. As for the finances, Chicago Public Schools CEO Pedro Martinez has expressed confidence that the district has the funds to cover the first year of this deal for sure, but there's going to be more work to be done going forward to cover things going forward. CTU officials and CPS officials have both said they need to petition state leaders for more state funding, and there's going to be more work done to handle pension payments to make sure that CPS has the costs and the funding to go forward with this after facing a significant structural deficit for years.
Okay, Matt Masterson watching the vote for us at the CTU House of Delegates. Thank you so much, Matt. Yep. For more on what is in the tentative contract, you can check out our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Cook County Sheriff's Office is ending its decades-old electronic monitoring program, giving the chief judge's office sole responsibility for managing those cases. Defendants ordered by a judge to be supervised with EM, or GPS tracking, will now be under the authority of the chief judge's adult probation department. The change means the department will have to scale up its staff, training, and equipment. But does it have enough support to do so? Joining us to discuss the move is Timothy Evans, Chief Judge of the Cook County Circuit Court. Judge, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brenda. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So proponents, including Sheriff Dart, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, who we heard from last evening, they've said that for years the electronic monitoring program should be consolidated under the courts, that the courts are better able to run it. What are your concerns with taking on a bigger caseload, and how much bigger might that caseload be?
Well, it is true that we have managed the system much better than the sheriff's office. And we've been doing this for 14 years. And we actually manage more people on electronic monitoring now than the sheriff does. So we will be ready. We're anticipating, to answer your question directly, that we will need approximately 150 more people. But we are scaling that up over four different tracks. And we expect that by August, we will have completed the first track, and we will be able to see whether our numbers, our projections, are accurate. We're anticipating that in about 6 months, we will have about 900 more people to keep an eye on. And that's on average about five per day and 150 per month. But the first day, it was 35. So I think our judges want to see how the system is going to work. But as time goes on, I think we will be able to manage it very well. And we have a dual balancing process. We have to presume that the accused are innocent at the same time that we have to protect the public. And so as we move forward with that kind of an approach, I think that we can do that, and we will be able to keep the public safe, and we'll be able to give people an opportunity to support their family, to prepare for their defense, to be able to pay their rent, pay their mortgage, using the system that we've been using for the last 14 years.
And you said 900 more in about 6 months, but it sounds like there's the chance that it could be more than that. And I also want to be clear to our viewers. There were two parallel programs, one that was operated out of your office, one that was operated out of the Sheriff's Department. The Sheriff's Department is, that one is being phased out, and those folks will instead be sent to the one that your office is already operating.
That's right.
Because this change, it took effect yesterday. How have you all been preparing for this shift since the sheriff announced that phase out late last year?
We've been working on it on a day-by-day basis with the sheriff, with others who are part of the system, the president's office, the state's attorney, the public defender. All of them have been involved in this, the clerk as well, trying to keep them abreast of our plans. We project that between now and the end of this fiscal year, which is the end of November of this year, we will need about 75 more FTEs. Those are
full-time employees.
Employees. And then after that, between December of this year and April of next year, we'll need another 75, and that's where the 150 come in. And I think we will be able to manage with that. The problem is that nobody knows what the future holds. Our judges are not clairvoyant. All they can do is use the evidence that comes in before them to decide whether somebody should be detained pretrial or free into the community pretrial. And this electronic monitoring that we're describing is in between those two systems. They are still free, quote unquote, but their liberty is somewhat detained.
Well, and let's get into that, because the Illinois Network for Pretrial Justice said in a release this week that many people on the sheriff's electronic monitoring program faced, quote, arbitrary restrictions that led to losing their jobs, being prevented from accessing medical care, going to the grocery store or the laundromat. What would you say are the differences between the program being operated through your office and the sheriff's?
Ours has always been more humane. We permitted people to keep their jobs in most instances. We permitted people to go to their doctor's appointments. We permitted people to go to the grocery store, to go to church. We were far more humane in the way we approached it, and we will continue to do that. But the judge can decide whether to keep somebody 24/7 or whether to give them a schedule that permits them to keep these services that I'm talking about. Most of the time, our judges permit the flexibility. But we want to keep the public safe, at the same time that we provide this humanitarian approach.
Now, speaking of safety, your office does not have the same jurisdiction as the sheriff, which the sheriff's office can arrest people. So how is your department going to handle violators?
Well, violators are handled in two ways. One, if it's a typical violation, they simply didn't follow the court's order. In those instances, we take the matter to court and we get a court order. We change the order that initially may have been applicable to that particular defendant. But if they attempt to cut that bracelet off, something like that, that's closer to an attempt to escape. And we can work with the sheriff and the other law enforcement officials to take action immediately to prevent that person from leaving the jurisdiction.
So can your officers just call the sheriff's department and they can just go and arrest that person? Or does that have to go through a judge who would then issue a warrant?
We would prefer it to go through a judge. But we will be working with all of the parties that are involved in this, including the sheriff, to see if we can make certain that we can expedite that process.
Okay, because that was going to be my next question. If it takes a while for that whole process to play out, what does that mean for public safety then?
Well, for example, we're going to be working with the state's attorney. We have a new state's attorney. We'd like the state's attorney to be notified and alerted when there's a violation at the same time that our office is alerted that there's a violation. That would give them an opportunity, as the person who represents the victims, to work expeditiously to protect the public. And we hope they will work with us to do that.
And to be clear, we did get a statement from the sheriff's office saying, quote, the sheriff's office is committed to supporting the office of the chief judge in the operation of their electronic monitoring program by providing any law enforcement services it may need to ensure public safety going forward.
We're going to be calling on them to expedite.
Sure you will, because violation does happen on occasion.
It does.
When the Cook County budget was passed back in November, $6.3 million was moved out of the sheriff's office to the Adult Probation Department for electronic monitoring. How much is this transition going to cost you? And is $6.3 million, is that enough to get you started?
No, it's clearly not enough. And we've told the president's office and all the commissioners that that's clearly not enough. And I'm projecting, as I said earlier, that we're going to need 150 more FTEs. And so you can't pay 150 FTEs with that small amount of money. But that'll be enough to kind of get things going. One of the big prices that we'll have to make an adjustment on, we have to find a place to house these additional FTEs. The space that we have now at 26 in California, bursting at the seams. So we've told that to the president's office and the commissioners, and that's the kind of thing that this money is used for. It's not all for salaries, but it's for vehicles that we're going to need. It's for phones that we're going to need. It's for desks and furniture and all those things. We want to be ready. We want to protect the public, and we want to recognize that these people are still presumed to be innocent when they're at the pretrial stage.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. It sounds like you've got your work cut out for you. Chief Judge of Cook County Circuit Court, Timothy Evans, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Up next, efforts to double down on diversity, equity, and inclusion. The Cook County Clerk joins us with that and more. Voters in Chicago suburbs took to the polls yesterday, casting their ballot for candidates as well as issues like ranked choice voting and raising the local sales tax on groceries. Cook County Clerk Monica Gordon oversees suburban elections. Last month, she marked 100 days in office, and in that time, she says she's seen an increase in requests for records like birth certificates and marriage licenses. She's also announcing a new DEI position in her office. Joining us now with more on all of that is Monica Gordon, Cook County Clerk. Clerk, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, as we mentioned, suburban Chicago elections were yesterday, or suburban Cook County, I should say. Voter turnout was just under 17%. So there are over a million registered voters in the county, but only nearly 300,000 ballots were cast. How does that compare to previous consolidated elections?
Well, honestly, it's a little higher. I would say in the last 8 years, it's higher. The highest it's been in about 8 years. But let me be honest, that's still not acceptable. The fact that we have under 20% number for consolidated elections compared to a 70% for presidential and gubernatorial elections. This is the election that really impacts you. It impacts the everyday voter. So we did a campaign. We did have a Vote Local campaign. And what this tells us is we got to continue to do these types of campaigns. And also we must conduct other voter engagement strategies to make sure we continue to increase that vote. But yeah, it's still extremely low, but surprisingly, it's higher than it's been in the last 8 years. And I want to point out early voting is higher than it's been since the pandemic year, which was 2021. So we did see a much larger increase in early voting, but there's a lot of work to be done, and I'm willing to do it.
A little bit higher, you said. Mm-hmm. Still not enough, but yes. A little bit higher. I mean, do you think there's been sort of a change in voters acknowledging the emphasis on local elections and the importance of them?
Well, I think the change we've been very diligent in making sure that this campaign is Vote Local campaign. We've utilized social media. We've utilized local newspapers. We also advertised a lot for election judges. We got a lot of election judges this year. There's about 1,430 precincts. We typically need about 6,000 election judges, and we hit that mark. So it's just a lot of information getting out to the citizens, getting out to the voters, but there's just a lot more work to do.
Leading up to the election, new data from the Cook County Treasurer's Office shows that predominantly white taxing districts showed greater participation with an average voter turnout rate in 2024 of 55.2% compared to 33.3% in black majority districts and 29.2% in districts with Latino majorities. What do voters need to know about the impact of local elections on their lives?
Your schools, your school boards, your library boards, your fire protection districts, the local municipal offices. This is all affected on this date in April. So we just implore people to learn more about get more engaged. Get more engaged, and it starts with also we have in my office, we want to do more with the youth. We want to do more with civic engagement with the youth within the schools to let people know about the importance of voting and voting local. It's not just about voting for your president. It's not just about voting for your governor, but you need to vote for your local mayor in these small suburban areas, these villages and small cities.
We've mentioned that your office is currently seeing a surge in requests for vital records like birth certificates and marriage licenses. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a couple of reasons, and let me be clear that we don't record information, but this is just based on some of the feedback that I'm hearing. In addition to the real ID deadline for May 7th, people are saying, you know, could it just be that? I don't think it's just that. When you think about birth certificates, there's been a 22% increase for the first 2 months of this year versus the first 2 months of last year. Marriage licenses and civil union licenses, 37%. There's a lot of fear and anxiety out there. People are worried about what's happening with the federal administration. And we're hearing those concerns. There was an example of someone told me about a family, a couple that drove all the way from Texas to get another civil union license because they were worried about what would happen in Texas. So they drove all the way here. And there are a lot of people who are worried about deportation. So they want to provide proof of citizenship for their children.
Okay. As we also know, the current administration, the current presidential administration, is targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion measures. Several public and private sectors have followed suit, abandoning their initiatives. But your office, you're creating a new position for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Tell us about that. And why are you doubling down on DEI in a time like this?
Well, I strongly believe in the principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think people just think about human capital with DEI, but it's more than that. And what I've learned is that when I was previously a Cook County Commissioner and I served under the leadership of President Tony Preckwinkle, we had a policy roadmap. It was a 5-year strategy plan. And every piece of policy, every piece of legislation, every budget allocation was rooted in equity. For instance, the district I had was a heavily under-resourced district, but more infrastructure dollars will come into my district because of that historical disinvestment. So we want those principles to make sure that everybody feels seen and heard at the clerk's office. Everyone is treated with respect and dignity.
Are you concerned about any retaliation for those efforts?
I am not.
Well, she's not. No. That's a very confident answer.
Yes.
When we know that some folks are intentionally going after every DEI opportunity that they get.
So when I took on this job, when I got into public service, I knew that it was my duty to do what's best for the constituents. And I think this is best for the constituents. We have a very diverse constituency in Cook County, and we need to reflect that. And we need to make sure that everybody feels a part of the clerk's office. Everybody feels like the clerk's office works for them.
Okay, you hit 100 days in office just last month.
Yes.
How would you describe those first 100 days, and what's your main focus as we head forward?
The first 100 days are really busy. I assembled a transition team of business, labor, elected leaders from across different sectors, and really looked at some operational and possibly policy changes within the office. And also, we decided to create a new position. And that position is Deputy Clerk of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And we're very excited about that. We're excited about, you know, just the different things we want to do. I talked about the voter engagement strategies. We want to make sure that we improve the clerk's office, building upon the legacy that the late, great Karen Yarbrough left.
Yeah,
we want to build upon that.
And I know that she was a mentor to you. You
yes.
were the second Black woman to hold that office. She was,
yes.
of course, the first. May she rest in peace. And best of luck to you, Cook County Clerk Monica Gordon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, an effort to empower teen girls. Teenage girls, including some who've been impacted by the criminal justice system, received an infusion of hope this week. It's part of an effort from the Chicago Department of Family and Support Services. The bold and brave Celebration of Girls was intended to inspire and empower girls with a focus on advocacy and wellness. Our Joanna Hernandez has this exclusive look.
I am the type of person that tell me I can't do something and watch me fly.
Nearly 50 teenagers filled a room at the Chicago Cultural Center for an event focused on celebrating being a girl.
For me, the biggest thing is just for them to be, hope this just ignites just one little piece of passion, or them to even ask themselves as to, what could I do?
Lisa Hampton works in the Youth Services Division at the Department of Family and Support Services. She organized the event, Bold and Brave, that's funded by a grant in an effort to bring more safe spaces for young women to express themselves.
The biggest thing is being able to help them understand how to be able to get connected. I think we're very lucky to have one of the largest councils that have a very regenerated interest in women and girls.
Girls ages 14 to 18 participate in various workshops throughout the day and hear from speakers like City Clerk Ana Valencia and 11th Ward Alderwoman Nicole Lee, who spoke about being trailblazers in their positions.
I find myself at 40 years old saying, I belong here, I belong here, I belong here. My experience matters, I matter, and I have something to say.
Topics included owning your narrative.
We have to empower our girls to be comfortable telling our own stories from our own authentic experience, because you may be able to repeat what I said, but you can't tell it like I can tell it.
High school senior Whitney Young Alexandria Almin was among the participants.
It seems like there's some kind of confidence epidemic. It seems like a lot of teen girls don't gain confidence until later in life when it's a little too late. So it's nice to see how much confidence is being pushed into our young girls so that we don't suffer from those self-esteem issues later in life.
High school senior Natalia Robles says events like this help her build the confidence to continue advocating for issues she supports.
I've seen a lot of women who don't feel that empowerment because they're not male, or because they think that their voices don't matter. And if I thought that way, I wouldn't be here right now.
The daughter of immigrants will be attending American University in Washington, D.C. this fall to pursue a degree in political science with the goal of becoming an elected official one day. She says having mentors and supportive spaces reminds her that she belongs.
I feel like it's really important for everybody to do this because, honestly, your voice matters. It's an impact. And if we're together as a community. Like, we can make the change. We are the change.
For Chicago Tonight Black Voices, I'm Joanna Hernandez.
And best of luck to those young ladies. This event was part of a larger initiative supported by the Girls Empowerment Motivation Grant that's provided through the Department of Justice's Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Renewed calls to ban teens from downtown after 8 p.m. That's after two high-profile shootings in Streeterville. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm serving Chicago for 37 years.